There was an article in The Nation in June of 2011, which discussed the Obama administration's aggressive war on whistleblowers. And the whistleblower in particular that the article mentioned was our guest tonight, Thomas Drake, who worked for the NSA, learned a great deal about how that agency operated, in particular about competing visions about what it should do, in particular about two competing types of technology or approaches, one called Trailblazer, one called Thin Thread, that led Thomas Drake to becoming a whistleblower. We pick up the story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Tom Drake, help me reset the scene here. 9/11 happens. There have already been discussions about these two competing versions. I guess they're competing, Trailblazer versus Thin Thread. Is there a point at which somebody somewhere says to the intelligence community, all bets are off, 9/11 happened, we need to protect ourselves, do whatever you need to do, regardless?
Well, yes. I mean, 9/11, many of us were not surprised at all, and that's another part of this thread. It's one of the tragic sides of this whole entire history. It is a fact. 9/11 happened, and it was an abysmal failure, a systemic failure of the system. There are those in government, though, that used it as justification for a whole range of things, or as a triggering event, and we'll probably talk more about that. You may even have listeners asking about it. But there was an edict. It was a memo sent out by George Tenet, then director of CIA and the DCI, the director of Central Intelligence, to all the intelligence agencies, saying, hey, whatever you got there, put it into the fight. And I was charged by the number three person at NSA, her name's Maureen Baginski, to go to the far ends of NSA and bring to leadership's attention those systems. I brought Thin Thread, as well as a number of others, to the attention of the leadership NSA to be put into the fight. And I quickly realized in short order that I was coming up against extremely powerful interests, corporate interests within NSA and elsewhere, to preclude that from happening. They actually looked at 9/11 as, in fact, direct quote, as a gift to NSA, meaning that we're going to get all the money we had ever wanted and then some because of the tragedy of 9/11. And it became extremely difficult to put the best that we had at the time, whatever stage it was in, out there into the world to find and unfold and unravel Al-Qaeda and the associated movements. It's one of those what if scenarios, you know, what could have been if the best America had actually been put into the fight, even as late as after 9/11. I'll get into what could have been known, what was discovered, or what was not shared prior to 9/11, probably later. But here it is 11 years later, and I live with all that history. So right after 9/11, I actually brought on a highly classified two-page document. I brought it to the Signals Intelligence Director's attention, and it was rejected out of hand. And I was told at the time, remember, it's important to note, Thin Thread not only would have provided superior intelligence in real time, even in the presence of massive amounts of data, you know, making sense of huge amounts of data, but it also would do so because it was designed in to protect U.S. persons. And so there'd be no violations of FISA or the Fourth Amendment without a legitimate search warrant, which there was a process for that, right, through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And that was rejected out of hand, and at the time, I couldn't imagine why. I mean, I said the only reason I can imagine why is that there was some other program that NSA was using, and there was already whispers in the hallway right after 9/11. Because there was people coming to me in private, and as I was going about, you know, discovering the best that we had to put into the fight, saying, hey, what are we doing, Tom? You know, I'm being told to take equipment and put it on U.S. Networks. I'm being told to take equipment that's normally outward-facing for foreign intelligence collection. I'm being asked to collect intelligence on U.S. networks. And I thought, we're not supposed to spy on Americans without a warrant, aren't we? So I began asking really hard questions, and we were fully prepared, Thin Thread was fully prepared to deploy to the most critical counterterrorism sites the NSA had at that time, and none of that ever happened. So it got rejected, and I remember pressing really hard. I said, why not? Well, they've gone with, I got a response back in writing saying that they had gone with a different solution, that thin thread wasn't needed anymore. Huge alarm bells are going off in my mind, okay? And I pressed even harder, and I was told, well, this is toward the end of September, we're very beginning of October. If you are that concerned about it, then you got to take it up. You know, go contact one of the attorneys and have them tell you why. In the meantime, one of the people that worked for me, we were working with the FBI to facilitate the probable cause. You have that probable cause. The affidavit information would be put before the court, the secret surveillance court, for a search warrant, because clearly there were targets in the U.S. that we needed to go after. He was and I were taken off that effort. Mysteriously. That's another huge alarm bell, because the fact remains that we still had to, you know, we're under the law, we're under the Constitution, and all of a sudden we're being removed from the very effort in which we're in partnership with the FBI going up before the surveillance court. And then I had the conversation with the attorney. Chilling conversation. Absolutely chilling. It was my moment of truth in terms of what then happened. I was told in no uncertain terms by the attorney that everything was legal, that the White House had approved the program. Now, this was not Trailblazer. This was another program, super top secret, highly compartmented. It's above top secret, and there's these different compartments. And it was a program that actually pre-existed 9/11. Interestingly, it's probably the, one of the first time that's probably been acknowledged in public. It's called Stellar Wind. But Stellar Wind, which we still do not know the full extent, we do not know the full scope and scale of that program even to this day, in partnership with General Hayden, the director of NSA, Stellar Wind was turned on the U.S. In very short order on a massive scale. And this attorney is telling me on the phone in very clear, very precise language, it's all legal, the lawyers have approved it, the White House has made NSA the executive agent for the program. Stellar Wind was always called the program. And you don't want to ask any more questions, Mr. Drake. And I remember in that moment when I was in my office, I hung up the phone, I remember going, reflecting back on the 1970s, I said, I am eyewitness to the subversion of our own Constitution. And if I don't do something about it, then I'm an accessory to a crime. And given the responsibilities I had, I'm going to have to bring this to the authorities' attention. But I knew, because they now had embarked on this highly illegal program, completely bypassing FISA and the Fourth Amendment, that in doing so, it would be fraught with peril. So I raised my alarms internally as best I could. It fell on deaf ears because they had already gone with this other program, and it was such a hush-hush program. There was a very small number of people that were even aware of it. The vast number, you know, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people work at NSA. We're talking just a few dozen people at most, were even aware of this program. And the actual people that knew about the program was even smaller that, in terms of what it did, was even smaller than that. So there were, I ended up contacting, okay, under the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act from 1998, I ended up contacting Congress. And in this case, it turned out over the period of several weeks and several months, going into 2002, I made contact with several staffers. But one in particular was Diane Rourke, who at the time was a professional staffer assigned to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, had a wide-ranging career in government, including the National Security Council, was well-versed in all of the machinations of government. But she had had the NSA account for the previous 3 years, meaning she was the day-to-day person on the staff for the Select Committee on Intelligence in the House, responsible for oversight with respect to NSA. And I brought the Stellar Wind program to her attention, as well as the fact that they were doubling down on Trailblazer and had rejected Thin Thread. So, you know, there we are. This is And what I did not know, George, at the time, what I did not know, came out later, suspicioned it, okay, is that President Bush had given the secret executive order in that first week in October authorizing the full program. It was already well underway, but it was actually a presidential authorization for the program. And I knew in early October that we at NSA, a Pandora's box had been opened up. A Pandora's box had been opened up, and that the Constitution be damned. And I remember internally saying, hey, you know, if the means by which we're to conduct warrantless wiretapping, if we're going to do that not under the law because it doesn't work anymore, there's a legal means by which you change the law in this country and you go to Congress. And then I was told, well, if we do that, Tom, they'll say no. I knew that was the second moment of truth. I knew then that this program was of such a vast nature, essentially was now going to treat the United States of America as the equivalent of a foreign nation for the purpose of blanket electronic dragnet surveillance. And that even at that time, where Congress would have signed off on just about anything. I mean, they signed off on the Patriot Act the last week in October with hardly any of them ever reading anything about the legislation. So the fact that they would say no, that Congress, they would not bring it to Congress's attention, although they had a wink, wink, nod, nod with the committee heads, the chair and co-chair respectively, I knew that we were way, way past. And it was really a conspiracy within the government to bypass the Constitution and put the U.S. on the equivalent of a continuity of government, which is outside the Constitution. So you have a secret government who's now saying, because, and this is the phrase that I would hear, George, exigent conditions apply. You don't understand, Tom, we live in, it's a different time now. Everything has changed. So here's the rise of the surveillance state. From my perspective, sitting there ringside, actually on the court, I witnessed the subversion of the Constitution right before my very eyes, never what I have imagined. And so there was a number of other things I was involved with, including two congressional investigations, two 9/11 congressional investigations, in which I reported in excruciating detail everything I knew about Stellar Wind, everything had been told to me about Stellar Wind, and all the massive fraud, waste, and abuse involving Trailblazer. And the fact that there did exist at NSA, this program called ThinThread, that not only would have provided all the core, satisfied the core requirements of Trailblazer, but it would have been able to go after the threat, including al-Qaeda and associated movements, in a manner which was legal and protecting U.S. person rights under the Fourth Amendment. All that was gone. All of it.
Can you tell me now, I know there are limits on what you can say even now, but can you tell me in general terms what the capability of this other program, whatever it was? I mean, are we talking about somebody listening, scooping up vacuum cleaner, like all emails, all phone calls, cell phones, everything, sticking in a computer somewhere?
Yeah, in rapid order. I mean, initially it didn't have that capability, but in rapid order, a whole lot of things were put into place over the intervening years. Remember, this program, in terms of the public knowledge of it, was super secret until one aspect of it was made public for the very first time in a blockbuster article, which ultimately led to my being put under the gun in December 2005, an article written in the New York Times by Eric Lichtblau and James Risen, revealing for the first time the existence of the so-called warrantless wiretapping program, which the government had conveniently labeled the terror surveillance program, which was only the tip of the iceberg. Stellar Wind really was the data mining program. It was the program by which, remember I told you to fly an RC-135, you scoop up everything? This is a program that was designed to scoop up everything, and in partnership with certain corporations, the electronic transactions, the electronic information and data, there was coursing through all kinds of networks within the United States. And it didn't matter if there happened to be U.S. person information caught up in it. This is what I was told, George, because I was objecting to this left and right internally. I said, oh, again, you don't understand, Tom. We just need the data. We never know when we might need to use it again or later. We just need the data. So this became, you know, the hoarding complex that you see these shows. Literally, NSA just said, you know what? It doesn't matter. 9/11 became the excuse. Stellar Wind was the program. We just need the data collected. We don't care how you get it. We don't know. We don't care where it is. We don't care if it's American citizens' data or not. We just need it. And so, over the course of the next year, this program was greatly expanded on a scale that we still do not know to this day. And you know, this is what Frank Church warned us about.
Do you happen to know the nature of the platforms that were used? I'm just wondering, and whether you're able to even say it, did they create some giant floating?
Well, there's certain things I still cannot say about the specifics in terms of implementation. But suffice it to say, pretty much anything that's electronic was fair game. So you're talking about phone calls, okay? And based on some existing arrangements that pre-existed 9/11, those arrangements with certain telecommunication concerns, which later they got immunity, so some years later when the program was exposed publicly, those arrangements were put into place. You also had technical capability in partnership with telecommunication concerns, it would allow you to basically mirror what was going across the internet, all the pipes of internet. Those could also be scooped up and pulled off and stored, as well as being monitored in real time by certain devices like the Naris device, a very interesting company that builds surveillance equipment. And so this is now the United States, for the purposes of this super secret program, it's no different than when I was on an RC-135. It's just now you're inside the information technology infrastructure of the United States, and you have this program that's designed to scoop up as much as it can, wherever it can, and keep it. In some cases for immediate action, in some cases we'll just store it and figure it all out later.
So surprising to me, I guess maybe it's surprising, maybe not, but as we've learned subsequently, the willingness of internet companies and providers to cooperate with this kind of thing.
This is another part of the tragic side of this, that the U.S. basically, with the exception of a couple of companies who did object, well, national security became the imprimatur, national security became the cover, national security was the overriding criteria in all of this. You just need to give it to us.
And they said, okay.
That's right. No wonder they were exposed when this all started coming out some years later and they needed immunity, and so Congress gave them immunity.
All that stuff that was collected back then by whatever platform was used, is it still in a computer somewhere?
Well, you know, there's a very interesting saying, I'm paraphrasing NSA, that once you collect it, you never delete it. There's, because you never know when you might need it again. There's a thing with secret surveillance. That's why I said, the Stasi example. They had these reams and reams. They became monstrously efficient at storing all these records. Well, now it's electronic. And, as the cost of storage rapidly decreased, it gives you the capability to store more and more and more in smaller and smaller amounts of spaces. So the driving tendency was get it and keep it. Just keep it. You never know when you might need it again.
I'm amazed by people who will say, and I'm sure there are people in our audience saying it right now, well, so what? If we're going after bad guys, you must have got a lot of really useful intelligence that helped us crack down on Al-Qaeda within our country or other bad guys. And since I have nothing to hide, so what? We're going to address that issue after the break. Men at Work, fitting song, I think. This is from back in 1981 about a guy who felt a little paranoid at the time, and I'm feeling a little paranoid myself after hearing this. Much more to come with Thomas Drake here on Coast to Coast AM. As we've just heard, NSA insider Thomas Drake, my guest tonight on Coast to Coast, working inside the intelligence community, found evidence of not only waste and fraud, but also a massive surveillance program, likely illegal, aimed at American citizens, scooping up all kinds of information, phone calls and emails, basically everything electronic, sticking it into some giant computer somewhere. He went through channels. He worked through channels within the NSA, told the Inspector General about it. He went through channels within the Department of Defense, told them about it, told congressional committees about it, and still nothing happened. So he had to take other steps, and that's what led to an indictment, a 10-count criminal indictment that could have sent him to prison for 30 or more years. We pick up the story right after this break here on Coast to Coast AM. Tom Drake, I'm sure that in our audience right now, and you must hear it every single day from people who say, look, I don't care if they're spying on me. I have nothing to hide. I'm sure that with casting a wide net like that, The NSA was able to get all kinds of useful information about bad guys and thwarted a bunch of terrorist attacks. So what's the big deal?
I hear that argument all the time. And in some cases, it's uninformed citizenry not realizing it's a false trade-off between privacy and security. And that the nothing to hide argument is really based on a faulty premise that privacy is somehow about hiding a wrong. If I have nothing to hide, hey, I don't care if my privacy is being violated. The problem is that the kind of surveillance we're talking about on the scale that we're talking about can inhibit the lawful activities that are protected under the First Amendment and activities that are essential to our form of democracy. So, you know, if you're going to violate, if you're going to give up privacy for the sake of security, you're going to lose both, as I'm paraphrasing Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, you deserve neither. Isn't that the statement?
Yeah. And deserve neither. Yes, it's one thing to give them up, and then if you're going to do that, yeah, you don't deserve to have either one of them. That's really what we're facing in terms of the threat here to the privacy. Privacy is absolutely essential to what it means to be an American. This is something I'm now more than aware of because of what they did to intrude upon my own privacy when they came after me with incredible vengeance and many, many investigators over a period of several years. It's as essential to the grand experiment of the Constitutional Republic. It's also fundamental to why we even had an American Revolution in the first place. Because back then, people, it's forgetting our own history, we're doomed to repeat it. You had the British Crown, basically with pieces of paper given to an officer, and they could just show up at your house and take away you and your personal effects. The Fourth Amendment fundamentally protected that, and you had to have probable cause to even violate your own privacy. It's fundamental to what it means to be an American. It's that critical, combined with the First Amendment. And here, with what I became painfully aware of, tragically aware of, is they're using the Fourth Amendment to absolutely violate privacy, and it became a direct assault on the First Amendment.
And it didn't have to be that way.
Did not have to be that way at all. That's the thing. The very best of American ingenuity and innovation had been, in fact, FinThread was prepared to go operational well over 18 months prior to 9/11. It provided the superior intelligence. It would have found the links in combination with certain other programs, and it absolutely protected U.S. persons per FISA and what was called USID 18, which was the Bible NSA in terms of how it had to actually implement the protections. There was even FISA had been amended five times since 1978. There was even what they call a hot pursuit option. You could actually pursue what you thought was a legitimate threat, even in the U.S. You didn't actually have a warrant initially. You have to go back and get one later, but there was a hot pursuit. So this idea that somehow it was inadequate to meet the times is again, another false red herring argument.
As I mentioned, you're working within channels. You went to your own Inspector General in NSA. You went to the Inspector General for the Department of Defense. You went to the congressional committees that had oversight of NSA, and it still didn't do what you thought needed to be done.
Well, worse than that, George, I actually became a material witness. I did not go to the mirror. I was having contact with Congress, right, at great risk, by the way, to my own career. But I became a material witness for two 9/11 congressional investigations. The Saxby-Chambliss subcommittee, it was a committee on Homeland Security that had just been stood up within HPSI. And then I became a material witness for the Joint Inquiry, which was a much larger, it was actually the prelude to the 9/11 commission. I became a material witness for them. And that was in 2002, during the summer. And I remember carrying in a satchel all kinds of documents, both unclassified and classified, to these investigators detailing what I knew about the Stellar Wind program, the information been given to me about it, the information about Trailblazer, what could have been prior to 9/11 in terms of what NSA, if implementing FinThread, deploying it, what they didn't do after 9/11. One of the things that we forget, this is history, Congress in early 2002, 9/11 happened, the Intelligence Authorization Act was delayed because of 9/11. in that Authorization Act, which was appropriated, signed into legislation, passed by President Bush, it directed NSA to deploy FinThread to the 18 most critical counterterrorism sites around the world. NSA defied the law and shut down FinThread. So, you know, I knew I was at the time because some of the key principals on FinThread had retired from NSA in disgust. They were not going to stand by and watch the subversion of their own constitution and then see elements of FinThread actually abused without any of the Fourth Amendment protections to spy on Americans. So they retired. I became the executive program manager for FinThread. And so, you know, here I am reporting what I knew to these congressional investigators, and including intelligence prior to 9/11 that was never shared with the rest of the government that could have easily stopped, blunted, prevented 9/11 all by itself. So,
well, I want to get into that in a couple of minutes, sure. But let's continue with your particular story. Oh, sure. I think at some point they figured, all right, this is the guy spilling the beans. They just stuck you in a desk in the corner, told you to go twiddle your thumbs. You become a non-person, and you become suspect as the primary leak in this New York Times story that you had nothing to do with. But you did start talking to a reporter.
Yes, I did. That's after I exhausted all internal channels and became the material witness for a multi-year Department of Defense Inspector General investigation, what they called an audit of the Trailblazer and FinThread programs. And the final report came out in 2005. And long story short, I ended up being, as you said, shunted aside. Basically, it was arabesque. Okay, lateral arabesque to a nondescript job without any authority, no people, no money, no position. And so I ended up down at the National Defense University as a visiting professor on strategic leadership and information strategies. Now, December 2005, the New York Times article comes out from Eric Wickblau and James Risen. I had nothing to do with the article. I was never a source, never had contact with them or through any other means. However, 2 weeks later, on December 30th, 2005, the Department of Justice launched a massive criminal national security investigation looking into the sources for that article. And it turned out in a subsequent article several years later in the summer of 2010, 5 full-time prosecutors, 25 full-time agents were assigned to find the sources. I knew... This is December of 2005. I'm still at NSA. I knew that there was a good chance that I would ultimately get caught up in it. It wasn't a matter of if, it was when. Why? Very few people actually knew about this tippy-top secret program called Stellar Wind or any of the other related information, or knew about the information NSA had not shared or information that we had discovered with FinThread, it turns out, on one of the main databases, indications and warning intelligence that they didn't even know they had in their own databases. So that investigation was launched. It led to them attempting to finger Congress and people that were in the intelligence committees, including staffers. That led to questioning of Diane Work. And because I had regular contact with her off and on over the years, particularly after 9/11, then it was a matter of, okay, when will they pull the trigger on me as a target? And so I'm now, and this is 2006, this is when the surveillance on a scale I would never want any American to experience began with me and became even more intense in 2007. And we're talking electronic surveillance. We're talking physical surveillance. As I was actually told chillingly by FBI agents later, and we'll get to that, I was told later, we knew your every movement. We knew when you left the neighborhood. We knew when you reported to work. We knew what vehicles you were driving in. So you can imagine the kind of effort they were using to keep track of me. In the summer of 2007, July 26 to be exact, Diane Rourke on the West Coast, she lives in Oregon, 3 of my former NSA colleagues were all raided by the FBI. And during that raid, those raids, they were asking about me. And a couple of days later, a couple of them came to me saying, Tom, we think you're probably next. They had just been raided. A whole bunch of papers had been taken. Their computers had been taken. And I knew then, it was now, it literally was just, it was going to be in the near future that the same thing would happen to me. And so in late November of 2007, November 28th to be exact, I'm looking out of my bedroom window and a dozen agents are streaming across the front yard. Now, you're asking, you know, about the reporter. There was a point, just so for context, in February of 2006, after thinking about it for a long, long time, over several months, I did decide to contact a reporter anonymously regarding unclassified information in terms of the fraud, waste, and abuse, and the wrongdoing, and the illegal activities, and the fact that there was a legal alternative to the top secret program, and that legal alternative was called Thin Thread. A series of articles have been published by Siobhan Gorman from the Baltimore Sun at the time, she was our national security correspondent, detailing a lot of things that were going wrong at NSA. And so I made an anonymous contact with her, and remember, the investigation had been launched, but I felt at that point that the only place left to attempt to hold the government to account was the Fourth Estate, in this case, under the First Amendment, the press. But I knew that contacting a reporter, I could lose my job. Never, but I did not imagine at that time that it would lead to what happened to me several years later, which we're clearly going to get to, which is the government came after me with everything they had. It wasn't just, hey, we don't trust you anymore. We're going to criminally indict you.
So let's get to that now. April 2010, sure. They indict you, 10 counts. Yes. I'm looking at these counts, and I don't want to laugh about it. It's not funny, but in some ways, it's like something that Joseph Heller would write, you know, Catch 22 or...
Actually, yes.
You're not charged with leaking secrets. You're charged with retaining information, some documents they found at your house, and the stuff either wasn't classified or had been declassified, or it was classified after they took it from your house.
That's the investigative reporter in you, George. That's precisely the case. I never was charged with actually leaking. There is a narrative they paint in front of count one, but it was 10 counts, five under the Espionage Act, one for obstruction of justice, and four false statement charges, which in themselves were false. The problem was they're all felony counts, and what I was facing was 35 years in prison. And that was almost two and a half years after they raided me. I was way behind the eight ball in terms of the inversion of the legal system. The government wanted to make had become an enemy of the state. As I was told later privately, elements within the government had decided they're going to make a scapegoat example of you. They were going to stake you into the ground and say, we're going to show what you do not want to do is dissent, speak up, or cooperate, okay, with investigators, let alone say anything, even if it's unclassified, to a reporter. So I was the case. There is no question. And interestingly enough, they had because I had been cooperating with them during the first 5 months after November 2007. They were quite convinced that somehow I was the source for the New York Times. It's an interesting thing when you read it. There was actually a secret indictment, a draft indictment, that they never actually approved it, in which it's very clear that I was considered to be a ringleader with others in conspiracy against the United States of America. I mean, it's just a total inversion. It was just, you talk about surreal. It's still surreal when I think about it. So here it is. It's blasted across all the papers in April of 2010. There's very senior spokesperson, had Lanny Brewer, heads up the criminal division of the Department of Justice, talking about how egregious this was, and we can't disclose national security secrets. It harms the interests of the United States. And there was even a couple of congressmen who were looking forward to seeing me in an orange jumpsuit. And so my circumstances with the government having control of the airwaves has painted me into a very, very dark corner. I must tell you, George, to be charged as an American with the Espionage Act, which is a World War I statute designed to go after spies and not whistleblowers, is about the most egregious thing as an American can face, because you are literally painted and labeled as a traitor, as one who has committed treasonous acts. You are a Benedict Arnold.
You know in your heart you didn't violate the law, but I got to think that you're thinking to yourself, look, I saw evidence within NSA that the Constitution doesn't matter, the law doesn't matter, they will bend it to their will. At some point, even though you know you're innocent, you had to be figuring, I could be sent to prison the rest of my life.
Oh, yes. I knew I was in the fight for my life. I really was. And here is the grand irony. What they ended up, what they call the charging documents, the documents they claimed were in violation of the Espionage Act. Interestingly enough, they charged me under a paragraph in the Espionage Act, Title 18, Section 793E, was actually passed into law under the National Security Act of 1950. After this is, there was a whole series of hearings in 1949. Senator Patton McCarran, McCarran International, he actually, which is Las Vegas, right?
Our senator right here, yep.
That is correct. He is responsible. He's acknowledged it publicly. You go back into the hearings, he inserted that. It was the first modification to the World War One Espionage Act that was passed in 1917 to deal with the Alger Hiss case with the so-called pumpkin papers caper. Here I am charged as the fourth person in history, okay, under that particular paragraph, with Ellsberg being the first. I mean, it's just, you talk about truth. So, yeah, you can't get any darker as an American. And, you know, that began my real nightmare. Okay, this is 2.5 years. I've been, you know, living with this for many, many years. Great personal cost. Had spent tens of thousands and then some. Was in massive debt. Had to mortgage my house. Had to basically cash out most of my retirement money funds. Here I am in the fight of my life. I'm indigent. I had qualified as indigent before the court. I was now being represented by public defenders. In fact, the Maryland public defender and the assistant public defender represented me. I was in a hurting place, and here I was. You know, this is unusual. I mean, it's under the Obama administration. I mean, the Bush administration had threatened prosecution, had threatened indictment, but here it is under the Obama administration. And even then, didn't realize at that time that I was going to be one of any number of people that were going to be charged under the Espionage Act after I was. But I was the test case. It is very clear that I was the test case, and I was going to be made a prime example.
But talk about surreal, though. At some point, it gets to court, and we'll get into this. We have to take a break in about a minute or so. But the government has to come to the court and say, you know, here are the charges. We can't show you the evidence because that would violate national security. It becomes even more surreal and bizarre. You just have to take our word for it, Your Honor. That
Alice
this guy
in Wonderland.
Yeah.
We
all right,
down the rabbit hole, and this is the grand irony. What the charging documents were actually in whole or in part the material evidence, unclassified, that I had given all those investigators years before.
Tom Drake, we're getting into the heart of this story now. Much more to cover here on Coast to Coast. Stay with us, everyone. It's just getting good. Much more to come on Coast to Coast.